Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Last week, after 8 years of negotiations led by China, Beijing inked the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership with 14 other nations, including some of America's closest allies like Australia, Japan, New Zealand, Singapore, and South Korea, to make the largest ever trade deal covering more than 2.2 billion people and a third of the world's economic output. The deal comes 4 years after President Trump withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, an agreement that was supposed to create one of the world's largest trading blocs that excluded China but included 14 nations. Joining us today to discuss the economic and security implications of RCEP, as it's known, are Matthew Goodman, the Senior Vice President for Economics and Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Matthew, start us off. RCEP is regarded as China's answer to TPP. That was a trade deal that was based actually remarkably on U.S. principles, U.S. principles of free trade, rule of law, workers' rights, environmental standards. How are these two agreements different? And what are the economic implications of what China has achieved here?
Well, RCEP is a shallower deal than TPP in the sense that it doesn't get into a lot of detail on some of the rules that govern trade in the region and beyond. And the tariff reductions are not quite as deep as TPP's were. But you can't dismiss RCEP, as some people are doing, as just a kind of superficial result, sort of Asian-style agreement that doesn't get much done. There's a lot of significance to this deal. I mean, first of all, as you said in the introduction, it covers about 2 billion people, about a third of humanity, about a third of world output. And, you know, some estimates show that this thing could have a significant economic impact, as much as $200 billion of additional global welfare from this agreement. You know, there are also some specific changes, like a single rule of origin for production that will affect production and value chains across the region. And the fact that Korea, Japan, and China all agreed to a trade agreement, first time ever. So that's significant. Patrick may have more to say about that. So I think, you know, we can't ignore the significance of this thing. And the fact that the United States is in neither RCEP nor TPP is a real problem for the United States economically and strategically.
We're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, Patrick, give us your sense, right? I mean, China doesn't do anything that doesn't have a very strong security dimension to it. What do you think are the most important security implications here? The advantages for China, but also potentially the disadvantages for the United States?
Well, let's define the word security here, Vago, because for the Chinese, security is largely and first about geoeconomic competition. And RCEP is a victory for China in this long geoeconomic competition that we're in. And as Matt just mentioned, I mean, you've got two major trade deals now in Asia Pacific, the comprehensive and progressive TPP without the United States, and now RCEP without the United States. So you've got the major future economy in bloc of nations with being guided more by China than by the United States, although China's not part of CPTPP. That's where Japan and Australia and our allies might be able to pick up this question about who's going to drive the standards and the norms for trade in this digital era, this fourth industrial revolution era of technologies like AI, robotics, 3D additive manufacturing. And for me, China's winning at least this chapter of this long book on geoeconomic competition. But as Matthew Goodman has just suggested, you know, this is not the end of the competition. This is really a symbol of China's growing economic weight in Asia. but RCEP is more of a warning than a mortal blow to the rules and standards that the United States, I think, wants to support.
Matthew, why don't you start us off, and then Patrick, what's the right way for the United States to respond at this point? Is it as easy as rejoining TPP? There is a sense that that's one of the options that's on the table, obviously with some modification. But sort of more broadly, how does the United States need to respond, given that there is far more at stake than just a trade deal? This very much is global leadership that's on the table.
Yeah, I totally agree. And leadership in the part of the world, the Indo-Pacific region, where, you know, all the growth is, all the dynamism, where we have critical strategic interests, and we've just got to be not only engaged, but really leading regional affairs, as we have done really for 70 years, 80 years. And part of the way we do that is military, but part of it is through our economic engagement in the region. And certainly for the last quarter century since we helped found the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Arrangement, APEC as it's known, which was the kind of the place from which TPP was born. That was a real conscious effort to make an investment in regional economic integration, you know, for the United States to be an active and a partner of the Asia-Pacific countries and a leader of rulemaking and norm setting. So we need to get back into that business. The free and open Indo-Pacific strategy of the Trump administration is a good concept, a good framing and structure, but it needs to have an economic and specifically a trade dimension that really hasn't been there. So our choices are either to rejoin TPP, or as it's now called, the Comprehensive and Progressive TPP, which is possible, and the existing members would probably welcome that. It's going to be a difficult negotiation if we go down that road, because they've taken some things off the table that we wanted. We'd have to get those back on, and a Biden administration is going to want some more things as well. So it would be difficult if we went down that path. The most difficult thing is the domestic politics here in the United States. TPP failed largely because of domestic politics. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump ultimately opposed the deal for political reasons, because it causes, as trade deals do, domestic dislocation. And people here were not enough people were convinced that that was going to be addressed with other policies. So I think a Biden administration is going to find those politics very hard. They've signaled in the campaign that they're skeptical about rejoining, at least two things happen. One, until we get our own house in order and make the domestic investments we need to make in our own competitiveness and equal opportunities here in the United States. And then that would be condition one. Condition two is that we get some of these changes in the agreement, like higher labor and environmental standards and some other things. So that's one possibility. I'm not expecting the Biden administration to jump into that, but they will have to come with something. When President Biden goes to Asia for the first traditional trip to the region in probably November of 2021 for the APEC and East Asia summits, he's going to be under tremendous pressure to offer something else, like maybe engagement on digital rulemaking, for example, as a start to getting back on that path to TPP, perhaps.
As Matthew, as you said, right? I mean, it became such a toxic political issue that the woman who helped negotiate it, Hillary Clinton, ended up running against it. Although there was a sense that she was going to make some minor modifications, but still stay fundamentally in the agreement. Patrick, how does the United States respond? What's the right way to respond? Because China is also trying to characterize this, you know, even though it was Me Too, in that it started RCEP negotiations after we started TPP negotiations. At the end of the day, right, they're the ones who led an agreement over the finish line, have a deal with 15 nations in full, whereas we're the ones who got out, and now because it will look like, hey, we're responding to the Chinese and we're getting back in. What's the right way to try to do this at the end of the day so that the United States doesn't look small, petty, confused, and sort of running around with like a chicken with its head cut off?
Well, the United States is partly self-marginalized with unilateralism, America First policy of Trump. We've been sidelined as well by China, which has been muscling its way to try to control the region. And polls show in Southeast Asia, for instance, that China's seen not just as their major economic player, but really as their major strategic actor. So the United States, under a Biden administration, first needs to burnish and restore brand USA. And I think President-elect Biden is already starting to do that just by his own rhetoric. He is a multilateralist, and multilateralism is exactly what the region is accustomed to on trade and what they want to hear about, even while everybody has a certain degree of protectionism within that framework or those frameworks. I think there is no quick answer here. Remember, this took 8 years just to get to RCEP. It wasn't just China-led. China just became the largest actor in that multilateral arena of 15 countries. This is going to take time, but something like World Trade Organization rules and re-engaging with that reform effort that was sort of dropped by the United States will be part of the Biden agenda. And I think, as Matt Goodman was suggesting, something like the digital trade rules may be very much at the center of what President Biden would put forward, maybe an overlay of democracies, trying to set the standards and the rules. And indeed, this is how President-elect Biden responded to the news that RCEP had passed, pending the ratification by a sufficient number of states in the coming months. It's that he wants to make sure that democracies help make these standards. So we're going to build back better, not just the Rust Belt, but hopefully the international trading system. But that takes time. That's much harder than it sounds. The reason Hillary Clinton and others, including then-candidate Trump, didn't support TPP, which was the U.S. sort of signature initiative under the Obama administration to play on the trading front in Asia, was because we were terribly afraid that businesses were going to be non-competitive on the global market. And so we were protectionist in a set. We walked away from TPP. But the answer is not to walk away from global trade. The answer is to make us more competitive. And indeed, the Democratic platform on which Biden ran says no more trade deals without investing in the competitiveness at home, education and infrastructure and wages. Those things are going to take time, but that's obviously going to be fundamentally has to happen. Those investments have to happen in the Biden administration for us to get back in the game. Then we can talk about re-entering TPP. In the meantime, we can try to help an actor like Taiwan, which is positioned to join, possibly be accepted. That would be a very much something that Beijing wouldn't be happy about, but would be much less of a red flag than giving diplomatic recognition to Taiwan. Not that that's on the table in the Biden administration. Finally, we need to build on India. Even though Biden doesn't care for the bilateral agreements, like a bilateral free trade agreement on digital with any particular country, the clean energy climate change agenda is so massive with India in particular. That may be a carve-out issue on which we could get into high-tech trade, and we could even make that a D10 initiative, democracies trying to push together on these new technologies that are related to climate change, that are related to the high-tech digital economy of the 21st century.
I find it fascinating that all of these questions about international trade are the same questions that Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson were dealing with when we were looking at, okay, you know, how do we do investment schemes? How do we work on education? How do we get to that next generation? I mean, interestingly on this, we will have split government, and historically Republicans have been somewhat less enthusiastic about investing in any of these priorities. As Democrats have been, which I think is extraordinary, given Richard Nixon was very, very bullish on the need to do exactly that agenda.
I think that's right, Vago. But if I may say, this is sure. Matthew, that I think that there is now a greater consensus about the points that Patrick made about the need to make domestic investments. I think that there's no question people understand we have to invest in our workforce, in our innovative edge in order to compete. And certainly in the short term, the Biden administration is going to be putting a huge priority on these issues, rightly so, because we have to deal with the pandemic itself and then the economic dislocations caused by the pandemic. So I think there will be more of a focus on domestic rebuilding. Sure, I think the Republicans in opposition are going to suddenly rediscover their fiscal prudence and resist some of the big spending plans. But I do have more hope that there's a consensus that particularly in the face of this competition from China, we do need to make some of these investments at home. And that is absolutely critical to our success in, you know, regional trade arrangements and a lot of other things.
Speed is of the essence here at the end of the day. And if you're going to tie whatever role in returning to TPP by sorting out sort of an ambitious domestic agenda for which there may not be as much bipartisan, right? There may be some Democratic support, ready Democratic support for it. There will be some Republican support for it, but there will be, as you said, I mean, you know, sadly, as we've been observing on this program, it is unfortunate for those of us who are fiscally somewhat more conservative are very, very frustrated that deficit reduction only becomes an issue for Republicans when there is a Democrat sitting in the White House. Matthew, how, you know, part of the trade wars and the Trump administration's approach to China has made Xi look at how the Chinese economy can retrench, how the Chinese economy becomes less dependent, for example, in the future to America pressure on it. How has this period changed how China is looking at this global order and trading system and how it's going to game it to its advantage? Because on every market, in every market, China has said it will become competitive. It has actually become competitive, whether rail, solar, you know, clean energy, right? A whole bunch of technologies that folks would laugh off. Well, you know, I mean, it's the Chinese guy and he's sort of third in the market, whereas now actually they're really market leading in many ways, even if they've stolen Western intellectual property. How does this economic competition start to look from China's perspective, given that it viewed some of these efforts to contain it as sort of war mobilization, if you will?
Well, I think China does see an opportunity, partly because of its greater capacity, partly because of our stumbling on some of these issues. I'd say that the trade war, to that question, has really accelerated a trend that was already in China of moving towards more so-called indigenous innovation, which is something that goes back to the 2000s before Xi Jinping became president. I think this has just accelerated and accentuated that trend towards China trying to become more independent or less dependent on U.S. technology and foreign technology, foreign capital. So I think the sort of unintended consequence of the trade war and the friction that we've had over the last 4 years has been that China has just doubled down on its own determination. So while it's officially gotten rid of some of its domestic industrial policy plans, at least by name, things like Made in China 2025 no longer exists in name, but in substance, it still very much exists. China is still committed to developing a whole range of capabilities in you know, advanced technologies, quantum AI, biotechnology, electric vehicles, and so forth, and pushing that out then with its other investments, you know, that you haven't mentioned, but you implied it, the Belt and Road Initiative, right, which is this Xi Jinping ambitious plan to build infrastructure in the world. That's gotten somewhat bogged down because it turns out it's quite difficult to build infrastructure, and it's you know, it's expensive. It's prone to corruption. It creates debt and environmental sustainability problems. And China hasn't been as vigilant about some of those things, and it's starting to bite them. It's coming back to haunt them. So Belt and Road has kind of slowed down on one level, but I think it may also redirect Belt and Road. It's not going to be abandoned because of Xi Jinping's precious legacy initiative. But they may redirect it to things like digital infrastructure, which are both sort of easier and cleaner to lay down in other countries, and also, you know, come with some of these technological inroads that China is trying to seek in these countries, building off of its domestic technological capabilities it's developed. So I think that game is still very much in play, and the United States needs to be conscious of that, not stopping this trend, because that's going to be impossible, but offering some kind of alternative to China's ambitions in this regard. And that's why we have to start by investing at home and then being smart about how we push out our economic statecraft.
Patrick?
Yeah, I think the gravitational forces in Southeast Asia in particular are going to be felt. China is moving from the United States to Southeast Asia. Now the 10 ASEAN countries are the largest trading bloc and trading partner of China. And they're surpassing now Europe and the United States combined. So you have a great effort, and combine that with what Matthew was talking about, the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, which, while it's touting $1.4 trillion of infrastructure projects, the reality is it's much less than that. It's much harder, but in place in its near abroad in Southeast Asia, in the south, around the South China Sea periphery, you can expect those projects to go forward with a vengeance. And so China is going to be pressing their geopolitical, geoeconomic desires, even while they're moving toward that greater self-reliance economically. So if you think about the next 15 years and the milestone of 2035 for Xi Jinping, where he really hopes China will have come back and be a major power on the global scale, this is really the competition we're in. And so when I think about a new book, like Dan Blumenthal's new book called The China Nightmare, which is just coming out, that's a very pessimistic view of both the Chinese Communist Party's future and Xi Jinping's economy, his ability to go from strength to strength. But right now, he is going from strength to strength relative to where the United States is, because they've bounced back from the pandemic faster than the United States, because they're now poised with trade deals, because they do at least have a major infrastructure and development plan. President-elect Biden has have to come to office maybe without much of a transition in January, and he's going to have to start working very closely and fast with allies and partners to try to fill in that empty economic space that the Trump administration has left really get hollowed out, even while they've worked very hard on the security and defense side.
What do you, I want to get both of your sense on, you know, over the years, number of people have written about the importance of the United States convening sort of a conference of democracies, because the Chinese, the Russians, obviously Iran, North Korea, among other countries, but chiefly China and Russia, want to sort of disrupt the rules-based order. They want to break the norms, right? There is concerns that the legal protection, you know, that China doesn't abide by many of the agreements it strikes. So it's really, really interesting that so many nations have cast their lot with China, understanding that actually the Chinese don't tend to live up to a lot of their obligations at a fundamental level. What do the cores of this conference of democracies need to be in order to craft sort of a uniform view of China, China as a threat, China as an opportunity, where you cooperate, where you don't? Because right now, the Chinese model is to find gaps, seams, you know, figure out who they can pressure to have them knuckle under and create an us versus them. And at the end of the day, no ally really wants to pick us versus them, right? I mean, that's the reason why many of our closest allies in the Asia Pacific are in both of these agreements. At the end of the day, what do some of the tenets of this sort of Congress of Democracies need to look like? Matthew, start us off, and then Patrick Kitchen.
Well, I mean, as a candidate, Vice President, then Vice President Biden did call for this Summit of the Democracies. And in the Foreign Affairs article he wrote back in March that covered this, he was fairly specific about what he thought that gathering should focus on, things like corruption and human rights. And sort of core fundamental democracy issues for democracies. I think that is an appropriate set of issues for something like a Summit of the Democracies to cover. I personally start to find it more challenging to think about how we push out from there to things above that kind of bedrock of basic values among democracies into things like rulemaking on economic matters, for example. So to take one example, Patrick mentioned in passing something called the D10, the Democracy 10, which is a proposal of the British to gather such a grouping. That group is the existing G7 countries, the advanced market democracies, plus Australia, South Korea, and India. And here's where I may have a slightly different perspective from Patrick's. No question, India is a critical, vital, large player, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region, really important from a security point of view, and hopefully at that sort of bedrock values point of view, although in practice right now, India is not performing perfectly in that regard itself, but you know, fundamentally okay. When it comes to economic affairs, India has been a disruptive force for many years. They don't really believe in open trade and investment. I mean, we started talking about the RCEP. Originally, India was a member of that grouping. There were 16 countries. India withdrew because it didn't want the competition from Chinese cheap products and services that would displace Indian production. And so they don't really believe in some of the fundamental economic rules that we're trying to propound. So personally, I like what's called a variable architecture in global governance. That is where you have different organizations and groupings to deal with different issues. So I think a summit of the democracies to talk about, you know, corruption, human rights, sort of basic issues like that, totally fine. Or at least there'll be lots of devil in detail, but an appropriate sort of broad agenda. When it comes to like rulemaking on things like trade and investment, and even the digital economy is a little bit mixed with India, I'd pick a somewhat different grouping. Maybe the other nine are a good grouping, but there may be groups elsewhere that could be assembled to take on specific issues. Like if you're dealing with something like semiconductors, you know, you want to get the big semiconductor producers, United States, Japan, Korea, Netherlands, a few others into the room to talk about how to, you know, build a platform of rules for that critical sector. So I'd say horses for courses, or, you know, variable geometry, as it's called in the business, is the right way to go. And one final thing, in that sort of galaxy of different organizations, I think there's a place still for organizations that include China and India, like the G20. You know, when you're talking about global economic growth, or you're talking about pandemics, or you're talking about climate change, you know, you need India, China, the other big countries in the room. And so I think one hazard, it's a final point, is that one hazard of just framing this as democracies on the one hand and authoritarian countries on the other is that you could end up losing a lot of that stuff in the middle, where we really do need to sit around a table and roll up our sleeves and figure out how to address those global challenges.
Patrick?
I think that's all good advice from Matthew. I think I'm picking up on the last point about inclusive architecture. APEC, the United States, will host that in 2023. Our closest ally in Northeast Asia, Japan, will host it in 2024. That's an opportunity for the Biden administration to plan ahead and to make sure that we're ready with these initiatives that are developed perhaps in other forums and other meetings along the way to set the standards and the rules with China at the table. Hopefully this can be something that will have more leverage than if the United States tries to go it alone or in only one forum. You have in India, yes, an obstreperous economic partner to some extent, although they look at us as problematic in many ways too. But you've got to take the long view here, just as China's taking a long view. And when you take the long view with India, working maybe on something like climate change and clean energy and technology for mitigating the carbon footprint could be a kind of a carve out area where we're able to work with India, big power, and then work with a smaller cluster of countries working on, say, 5G telecommunications, so that we've got that trusted network, and giving them more support and making sure that their standards, not China's quest for cyber sovereignty, for no data privacy, for other things that are going to step on our values, make sure that they don't become the norm globally, just as China will want them to become the norm globally. One point here, Vago, just is that even as they're signing this world's largest free trade agreement, essentially, with RCEP, at the same time, China is penalizing Australian goods being held, you know, through regulation. So it just shows you that just because there's a free trade agreement doesn't mean there's free trade. China still wants to apply its rules, its own separate rules, even while it pretends to play by sort of the global or regional norms.
Let me ask one last question. We've got less than 2 minutes left, but get both of your senses on this. Many of the nations in Asia, China, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Pakistan, others have managed to control the coronavirus. In fact, China has broken its back in part because it did a hard and fast lockdown. Troops supplied food to affected areas so that people didn't have to go out. Mask wearing was compulsory. Europe and the United States, and especially the United States, we've had a million new cases in less than a week. We are at the verge of what could be an absolute calamity, and folks are still debating whether or not to wear masks, viewing it as sort of you know, virtue signaling. Right, at the end of the day, how does this reflect on, you know, at a time when you're, when democracies are competing against authoritarian states, that where the United States is trying to assert its leadership, doesn't that leadership role and the value of democracies, or the word of democracies, or maybe the efficacy of democracies, ring hollow to people around the world when we prioritize opening up as opposed to conquering a disease? And now we're looking at hundreds and hundreds of thousands dead and millions infected. Matthew, and then Patrick.
Well, I do agree with the fact that the pandemic has really revealed or you know, highlighted further real failures of two things that Martin Wolf of the Financial Times had a great sort of pairing of concepts that he said are the essence of leaders in the world, which are competence and decency. And really, in the last few years, the United States has not demonstrated either. And the pandemic has really put an accent on our failures of competency. And I would say, you know, in the way you framed it, even of decency, in the sense that, you know, putting on a mask to help prevent others getting sick seems to me a minimal contribution that citizens can make. And we're not even sort of willing to do that in many places. I think that we have to fix that domestic pairing of issues, competence and decency, if we're going to really be the kind of leader that people want to follow, which we've always been in the past, because for all our failings, and we don't always live up to those two things, we've been broadly more competent and decent than we have been the converse. And we've got to get back to that.
Patrick?
I think we get to reset here because of the election. And a Biden presidency will be graded on its actions once President Biden is in office on January 20th. And I think because he does have a comprehensive approach, because he's embracing science, we're going to climb out of this. And eventually, we're going to look a lot better in 2021 and beyond than we do in 2020. And I think that will go at least some way toward restoring trust in our brand and our reliability and our sort of model. But it's going to take a lot more than that as well. But science still very much at the center of a Biden administration, from my perspective, will be important for him to embrace. He's got a great opportunity to kind of cast the New Frontier speech, the inaugural speech of John F. Kennedy 60 years ago.
Gentlemen, thanks so very much. Always a pleasure having you both on, and look forward to having you on again, because obviously this issue's got to be discussed. And Matthew, would love to get much deeper with you on what do we have to do domestically in order to pass what will be a very, very important international trade agreement. Gentlemen, thanks so very much again.
Thank you, Vago. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Vago. It was great.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.